Amen. All right, house cleaning really quick. If you notice on your syllabus, you do not have class Thursday or Friday. Okay? I'll be across the pond. So that's all you really need to know. No, I'm just kidding. I'll be thinking of you as I'm going on my train from Heathrow Airport to University of Nottingham. I might think of you. It's possible. My kids are convinced that I'm going to run into Robin Hood. They're very excited. However, here is the temptation that you will do nothing during your 9 o'clock hour on Thursday and Friday. Do you have the right, and are you grown-ups and can do that? Yes, you can. Here is my encouragement, though. You have a date and author assignment due next Tuesday. And I purposefully made that assignment due after Thursday and Friday, because you will have already blocked off in your schedule 2 full hours on Thursday and Friday to be working on the author and date. Does that make sense? I did that on purpose, because it is going to be a tough assignment, but you don't have class the 2 days before it. So it kind of balances itself out. Okay? So please, utilize those 2 hours. You don't have to. You obviously don't have to. But I do not want to hear, "Oh, I'm sorry, Shane, I didn't have time to get it done." Well, sorry, that just won't fly. Because you had 2 days off. Fair enough? Any questions about the Dayton author assignment? No? Ooh, I do have an opportunity for extra credit. And I don't even say that word very often in very many of my classes. But this will actually help my teaching of future classes. And so I think it'd be good for us even to try it in this class. Once you establish your date, if along with your assignment you email or you give me on a whatever, like you put it up into a cloud and I have to download it or whatever, a picture or two pictures from the time period of an artifact or a piece of architecture or a coin that would impact the time period that you have for your date and send it to me, then you can get extra credit. Does that make sense? What I'll probably do is go through them, and we'll just have maybe like the first half of a class period going through the different ones, and you can say why it impacted, what you think it was about, and then I'll give some thoughts on what I thought it's about. And the reason why is because we'll talk about more tomorrow and next week, how architecture and coins of that nature were the billboards of the empire. And so it'll be really important to see if they only have a limited space on a coin to say as much as they want, as much as they can, that means everything they put on there is tying into some major imperial propaganda that they're trying to get out to all the people. And what better way to do it than on the things that everybody has to have, and that's the coins. Or the architecture. If you're building one building, you're going to pour all this money into it. What you put on it probably matters. It better reinforce what you are wanting to say to the people. That's why all of these are billboards, imperial propaganda. Any questions about that? So email me the pictures of the time period that you think that your book is written in, of either architecture or coins or things of that nature. Don't email me documents or texts. I can read those on my own. Email me pictures. Yes?
You said that's to impact the time period, but it also has to impact the book.
No, in other words, if you land on the date of Revelation in the time of Domitian, I don't want you sending me stuff from Augustus. I mean, that's 100 years removed.
But if I send you stuff from Domitian, I don't really have a connection to Revelation.
Say it one more time.
Like, I have Galatians.
Okay.
If I find stuff from the period or from maybe even the regions of the cities I believe it's to be written from, but it doesn't really, I mean, there's no significant tie to the book. Other than just building general historical context.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have to see the imagery within your book. I don't know if that's what you're asking. But if it's written during, like, for example, Galatians, probably written in the time of Claudius. Although you can, whatever you decide, I'll acquiesce to. Unless you put it to the second century, then we'll have a go. But I want to see imagery from the reign of Claudius. That's all I'm saying. No, you don't have to show that. Like, you don't have to show the coin of Domitian's son holding 7 stars Only, you know, even though it comes up in Revelation, that's not the type of stuff I'm looking for. I'm looking for what are the things that they're talking about during the time period that your book was written. Does that make sense? Okay, good question. Anything else? You guys got it all down? You're 400 level. All right. Dating. We were talking about the dates of books and whether or not they were important. We split up into groups and you guys came up with some lists and we started going through those lists. What I'd like you to do now is to continue that conversation. What other reasons why the date of a book or the author of a book may be important? What are some of the ones we've listed so far? Let's start there. We went through like five, I believe. Can you remember any of them? Yeah, cheat. Get your notes out. It's okay. What? Say it again.
The date gives you cultural perspective.
Yes, it starts to build an environment from which you can start to see the sociological factors that are impacting what's happening in your book. Yes?
It gives the author a voice and a personality.
Yeah, it does. It adds color to the author. It allows you to even maybe see through to some of his emotion or some of his own experiences that impacts what he's writing or what he is not writing may be significant as well. What else?
Words and
language.
How they develop and the differences in different cultural backgrounds of words.
Absolutely. Yeah, if we know a date or even an author, because sometimes even the author will impact the way in which a word is used, then we are able to even start to develop some of the language that's being used and how it impacts our interpretation of not just the verse, but maybe even the whole book. What else? Good.
Validity of the book?
Yeah, it does impact some of the authority of the book, be it the author, more specifically the author, although the date would be significant as well. The fact that Luke was traveling with Paul gives a little bit more authority to his account. Does it give him more authority than somebody that wasn't there? Not necessarily when it comes to theology, but when it comes to actual historical facts, the we passages do say something. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Ramsey, and the shipwreck in Acts 27, obviously that's what converted, or I shouldn't say obviously, that is the passage that converted him because he was a yachtsman. But one of the things he did conclude was that it was someone that was an eyewitness that was describing this, but it was not someone that was familiar with actual sailing and traveling, which would have fit Luke. Yes?
I don't know if you said this, but audience, it gives you like an idea of like what your audience was going through, whoever they were writing to, and like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's play with that for a minute. That's really good because really the date of Mark will be a good example of how it affects the audience and really the environment in which it was written. If Mark was around 55, a pre-62 date, the book of Mark, if it was written around then you're writing in the time of Claudius, which whenever you're researching Claudius, you'll find it was pretty relative tranquility for the church. Now, don't get me wrong, for the Jews, there were some problems in 49 when they were expelled from Rome and things of that nature. But you don't have direct persecution on the church. And really, the empire as a whole was somewhat in stability. Was not instability, but was stable. Was stable. However, if I move the date of Mark to 66 to 70... all of a sudden now, stability is not a word that they have heard for quite some time. That's where 69, the year of four emperors. Matter of fact, even though you have a switch from the Julio-Claudian dynasty into the Flavian dynasty, Suetonius describes that switch as a gift from God, not because they switched dynasties, but because the Flavians brought order back into the empire. And that would affect the way in which we read the book. If it's a time of turmoil, all of a sudden, it's pretty odd that the opening verse of the Gospel of Mark is one of the most politically explosive verses in the entire Bible. If, for example, let's just read. Let's just read the opening verse of Mark. Fresh on my mind because of what I lectured on this morning. Tough. You weren't. Well, not all of you were there. Some of you were there. Sorry. Mark 1:1, the beginning of the Gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. If you're writing in 55... it might just be kind of an apologetic of the identity of Jesus. A good spiritual statement about who he is. If you're writing in 68 to 70, whenever you have four emperors that are claiming the title Son of God, And whenever you have the emperors being attached to the ones that in the Priam calendar, 9 BC, they're called, the one, Augustus is the one that at his birth, the beginning of the good news, is the exact phrase it uses in the inscription. The beginning of the good news happened at his birth, the beginning of all creation, the beginning of whenever all things got their breath. Those are three ways that arche is used describing Augustus. When you start putting that stuff in the context, and then you see that it says in the arche of the Evangelion, the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, all of a sudden, you don't have an apologetic of the spiritual statue of Jesus. You have a politically explosive statement that is being lobbed into a conversation of a politically explosive Rome. And what Mark is saying to the Christians in Rome is, yeah, it just gets worse whenever you truly understand who Jesus is. Because that means your very life could be threatened. At that point, I would say the date matters. You see the difference? Because right off the very bat, Mark is issuing a challenge to the Christians that are reading his book. He's saying, in this time period, when everything's in flux, you need to know the one who's in control. I don't care what Galba, Otho, Vitellius, or Vespasian are claiming. I only care about the truth about the one that is claiming what it is that it is true. And that is, Jesus is the King. He is the beginning of the good news. He is the Son of God. Ooh, that'll preach. Write that down. I'm going to write a sermon on the dating of Mark. Do it. Yes, there's a hand. Mallory or somebody? No hand? None? No. Okay. Yes? Yeah.
You did say that in 55, fought into the ring, but Nero discovered late 54.
Mm.
But he didn't go crazy until about 60.
You're right. Yeah, still tranquility. He doesn't go crazy until around the time Seneca dies in 65. Although in 64 with the burning of Rome, with the pressure he had, yeah, that was definitely crazy. More than likely because of syphilis, in case you're wondering some of the conjecture out there. Yeah, that's a good point, though. Bottom line was still period of tranquility. Yes?
Now, if Mark was written in 55 and 62, wouldn't that language still have been common language and political language?
Yes. Yeah. But he would be basically, it is political language, but the implications of him saying that are much different. In other words, would it have still been somewhat politically explosive? Yeah. But if you use that rhetoric in a politically explosive climate, it becomes all the more of a something that can get you crucified. If you use it in a predominantly tranquil environment, it'll get you attention, but it may not be something that is more than less just brushed under the rug. But if you're saying, no, if this guy's saying, I'm Son of God, I'm Son of God, I'm Son of God, actually let me throw in a fifth one to you four emperors and say that he's the Son of God, all of a sudden it starts to take on a new life of its own. Yeah, the political dimensions of it, though, they begin all the way back in 29 BC to 9 BC. Yeah. You see how this makes sense? That's why you got to know the whole story, though, of the way it's moving. Because if you only know this little chunk, and this is where we're even going to expand this, you need to know your date. But we're going to be talking about those that come before and after, because your date comes into in a river of day, of a story. It's not just its own little pond. It's in a story. It's in a much bigger river that we have to know how it is flowing. And the way that Augustus treated the imperial cult is much different than Caligula and Nero and those after. Much different. How different? Well, we'll talk about that when we talk about the imperial cult. Good, 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 good. Anything else? Yes?
Would it also be helpful to know what was being written around the same time?
It would. And you know what? We're going to get to that today. That is fantastic. It would be helpful because what you're able to do is to start using other sources to impact your particular book. And we'll talk about that later today. But yes, the date of the book allows you to actually have conversation with other authors that are writing both in your community and outside of your community. Very important. Let me give you an example of the way in which not only does it affect, maybe the purpose of a book, but even the entire interpretation of a book. Go to Revelation chapter 11. Right now there's a major debate raging in Revelation scholarship over the date. For years everybody had landed that it was at the end of the reign of Domitian because of what Irenaeus said. So they date anywhere from 94 to 96. However, more recent scholarship, which is not normal for scholarship to do this, but more recent scholarship says, no, it's not at the end. Now what they want to do is they want to take the dating of Revelation before 70. What's odd about that move? Yeah, well, yes, yeah, scholarship usually says, oh, that book's not early, it's in the second century. Like, they lob it as far away from the time of Jesus as they can. Revelation's a weird book, even in dating. They go, no, we're not going to have the late date of Revelation. We want the early date of Revelation. Matter of fact, I was sitting in a lecture 2 years ago in Edinburgh, and this guy, I can say his name, he'll never hear this, Timothy Barnes, was giving this lecture on whether or not he thought Christians were crucified in the first century. And out of nowhere, he starts talking about Revelation, which, you know, piqued my interest because that happens to be what I'm interested in. And he makes this statement. He says, any scholar that has studied anything at all about the Revelation knows that it was written before 70. I was like, dude, I guess I don't know anything. I didn't realize it, because I think it's written after that. But that's where scholarship's at right now. And usually they'll make... He's particularly... what's the word? Given to making ridiculous, audacious, overstating statements. But a lot of scholars do that. They will do that. Those, anybody that doesn't agree with me is a moron, and they obviously haven't picked up a book and don't even know how to read or write, you know. They'll say stuff like that all the time. But Revelation, if you read it pre-70 lens, it completely changes the key symbols, especially in chapters 11 through 18. Completely. Not even close to the same interpretation. Let's look at chapter 11. I was given a reed like a measuring rod and was told, go and measure the temple of God. Stop right there. If you're reading this from a pre-70 perspective, what could that interpretation be of what's being commanded to do here? Go measure the temple that is standing in Jerusalem at the time in which this letter was being written. Right? But if you're reading post 70 in 95, 96, what do you do then? What is the temple? What is it?
The church.
Maybe it's the church. Well, that makes sense. Have we been called the temple before? Yeah. Wow. Those are drastically different implications. Because of what happens over the next several verses. Because of the pre-70 date, in chapter 11, that is literal temple. But then chapter 17, when you see the prostitute, how, if you're opposed, those of you that have taken my Revelation class in 95, 96, how did we define the prostitute? What?
Rome.
Where do we get that? Revelation chapter 17, verse 18. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Who is the city that is ruling over the kings of the earth? Rome. However, if you are pre-70 and you think that the entire purpose of the book of Revelation is to foretell the destruction of the temple, and there's a literal temple in Revelation 11, the way that Revelation 17 is interpreted for you then is that the prostitute is Jerusalem. Big difference. Therefore, in Revelation chapter 18, the fall of Babylon, if you're a 95-96 date, you're describing the destruction of Rome. But if you're a pre-70 date, it's the destruction of Jerusalem. The dating kind of matters. For some books more than other. But in Revelation, it's huge. You following me? I'm basically making an apologetic that we really do need to pay attention to the assignment that's coming up next. Because it'll affect the way you read your book, whether you know it or not. It will. Yes? Yeah, that's a good question. Because some of the interpretive details we're dealing with here don't have salvation issues attached to them. For example, a major proponent of the pre-70 date that's very broad out there is Hank Hinegraaff, the Bible Answer Man. He believes in pre-70. He believes Revelation was written. Now, I don't agree with him at all. I don't think he's going to hell for it. I just don't think he's paying attention. Matter of fact, whenever I've read his fictitious books on this, he never once mentions one of the seven churches of Revelation, chapters 2 and 3. I have a problem with that. Because then all of a sudden, this is something I have a problem with, although it's not a salvation issue. Whenever you take it away from the people it was directly written to and you make it what you want, at that point, interpretation just becomes whoever has the biggest stick on the block. And that can lead to dangerous places. Although the place that Hank Hinegraaff is in, I don't agree with, but I don't think he's in danger of changing who Jesus was or what he accomplished. So no, is this intra debates? Yes, but the implications that all heresy is born out of some place, some derivation of orthodox. I don't believe Hankinograph is heresy. Hear me, okay? However, dispensationalism is. And I have no problem with that, because if you change who Jesus is or what he accomplished, that's my line. And reinstitution of a temple sacrifice that in Ezekiel is for atonement, I have a problem with. And whenever I'm talking to them in their interpretations of Revelation, which what they do is they totally ignore the date, by the way. See, the dating issue even affects them. They don't even care about chapters 2 and 3. That's why in 13 books of the Left Behind series, Revelation, you know, Ephesus, none of the cities are mentioned. Why? It doesn't matter to them. The date doesn't matter to them at all. All that matters is how is everything going to end up at the end of everything? And so what they do is they grab it, rip it away from its date, and they bring it 21st century and they make it whatever they want. The date does matter then. Then what they do is they come up with this rapture stuff, which they force into Revelation 4:1 and a reinstitution of a temple, because in Revelation 11 it says there's going to be a temple. So we have to rebuild one, and we'll pattern it off of Ezekiel 40-48, where we reinstitute the sacrifices, and in Ezekiel 45, it says those sacrifices are for atonement. And I've asked one of them, excuse me, but I have a problem with that being for atonement. And they just say, but during the 7-year tribulation, the sacrifice of Jesus will be suspended. And I said, that's where we have a problem. Because who Jesus is and what he accomplished for me cannot be changed. And when you cross that line, that's called heresy. So no, I don't just get upset because we have a different interpretation. I get upset because what they're doing is changing who Jesus was and what he did. And it all goes back to dating. If they would keep it in the first century, and in the Jewish context, and in the Old Testament context, in the traditions that helped create this book, then they couldn't get away with all the fantastic things they get away with. Why? Because in 404 verses of Revelation, 516 allusions to the Old Testament occur. If you know your Old Testament, you know Revelation. But if you don't care about the date, you don't care about its sources, you can make it say whatever you want. See the issue? Now, they are worried about authorship, because John, an apostle, predicting the future is really important to them. But dating, who cares? So with me and Hankinograph, we don't have a problem. I think he's wrong, but you know, whatever. That's fine. He thinks I'm wrong. That's cool. But it does have effects on theological issues other places. And it all goes back to the central issue. I care about the date. You don't. And you can do whatever you want with it at that point, because it has domino effects. Is everybody tracking with me here? And I'm sorry if you're going, wow, he was really harsh on Left Behind series. I don't have enough time to develop that in here. That's for another class, another day. Okay? And if you disagree with me, it's okay. We can still be friends. You called me a heretic. Yes, I did. So examine what you're believing. and we can talk about it, and I'll love you through it. The implications are nonetheless still there. I could build that more, but I don't think we have time to do that. We need to get through other stuff. I will say this, though. a dispensationalist doesn't even believe that the Sermon on the Mount is for the church. Well, I believe that. I'm a dispensationalist. You're not being consistent with your theological agenda. The Scofield Reference Bible, even at the reference notes underneath the Sermon on the Mount, says that this neither gives the privilege nor the duty of the church. It's for the kingdom alone. And the kingdom, when Jesus came to establish, was not rejected until Matthew chapter 12 at the Beelzebub controversy. Therefore, everything before that's for the kingdom, everything after that's plan B, known as the church. I have problems with that. Anyway, get away from Revelation. Sorry. Point is, dating of the book can change the interpretation, can change the implications, can change the purpose of the whole book as a whole. Sometimes it can have much more drastic effects. And sometimes it can be just different nuances. Bottom line is, you need to establish what is being affecting the interpretation of your book. Does that make sense? Other thoughts on that? Okay, we talked about authorship and how that affects somewhat. Like, for example, I think I've given you guys the Mark example. Knowing that John Mark was the scribe or the interpreter of Peter's preaching changes the way that we read a lot of the sections in the Gospel of Mark. Right? Okay, what I want to do now is I don't want to just throw you in and just say, okay, now go figure all this out. What I want to do is I want to spend a whole day, maybe even part of tomorrow, going through two things. Number one, I want to lay out for you the way I do research on this stuff. so that you know where to start, where to move, how to do this. I'm not going to leave you like a fish out of water and just say, good luck. Let me know if you actually are able to evolve. that was a little creation science joke there. Okay. The second thing I want to do is I want to talk about what Hannah brought up, and that is sources outside of your book that will impact the interpretation of your book. Somebody asked me, how do you get to this information? Just like you get to every other piece of information, that needs to come back on. A lot of reading and a lot of digging. However, there are certain places that are more effective to dig and to read. Come back on screen. Awesome Blossom. Seriously? Well, this is going to make it hard for me to show you how I do my research if you can't even look at what I'm doing. Seriously, that was like seconds before I was about to use it, wasn't it? Was it? What was it doing? Did anybody see it before it went off? Don't touch it? Oh, that's because I was pushing the button. See, watch. Watch this. Huh. Well. No. Oh, yay. Who prayed? Good job. Good job. Okay. What I want to show you first is how I use the IVP dictionary that you guys were told to buy according to the book that you were going to be getting. You follow me? Very beginning, I told you there was a third hidden textbook that you had. It was one of the IVP dictionaries that correlated to whatever book you landed on. You needed to get a whole... I told you to buy it. You're not required to buy it, although you should have it in your library. If you can get the whole set, do it. If you have Logos, you already have it. Probably, depending on what section you're at. I have the Scholar's Library Gold. I don't know all the divisions, but that's the one I've got. This is the Dictionary of the Later New Testament and its developments. Okay? There were three of them I talked to you about. Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels, Dictionary of Paul and his Letters, Dictionary of the Later New Testament and its developments. So Hebrews is actually found in here. Apparently they're making an authorship statement by putting it in this volume. Dictionary of its Later New Testaments. What you do is you find, and you're required to do four articles from this dictionary at some point. But you find the articles that directly impact your book. There will be an article on each of your books. So there will be an article on Hebrews. That'll be a good resource for you to go to. But let's just, for example, let's just say you're going to be looking up something on the tabernacle for some reason. It's got great information, and obviously you can look through it. Terminology, tabernacle in Acts, tabernacle in Hebrews, tabernacle in 1 Peter and in Revelation, and the Apostolic Fathers, which is always good not only to go with contemporary Christianity, but even to look at how early church fathers were interpreting things from your book. That can help you understanding how the book is because they were a little bit closer to when the book was written, which always seems to help. Here's where these books are worth their weight in gold. Notice right here the word bibliography. Now look at how extensive this bibliography is. Well, it goes on for that page. But still. What is beautiful about the bibliography is this. Is it helps to start put you on a track of the key resources. That's nice. That's handy. In other words, whenever you look at Hebrews or one of the other books, and then you get to the end of the bibliography, it can put you on the track for the most effective and meaningful sources that will help you point you to the other sources. And this is what you do. First of all, let's say like we go to GB Chances, Jerusalem, the Temple, and the New Age in Luke Acts, and we read it because we're studious. But what's important about his is not just what he says, but where he points me to. What are the sources he's interacting with? But then you also need to notice his is in 1988, which is he's interacting with different sources than the guy in 1950, which is different sources than the guy in even in 74. You see how that works? And you go on a bibliographical hunt. And you start connecting, you see what sources are the key ones that are being talked about, and then what sources are they using? And then what sources are they using? When does it stop? It doesn't ever have to, but you stop whenever you basically just say, I can't research anymore, I've got to write. Does that make sense? One of the best places to start is these IVP dictionaries. One of the best places to start is these because it gets you on a track of the key sources. And this is not even just your New Testament intro class. This is for every class that you take at Ozark. Whenever I write any paper, even including my PhD, I don't necessarily go to Dictionary of the IVPs now, but I do this. I go on a bibliographical trail, and I just follow and what's being talked about. The second thing you do, and this is the one that I go to first and I spend the most time on. Where's that? Is EBSCO. Tell me you know how to use this. Literally, when I begin my research, I obviously click all of them, and I will literally spend 3 hours researching and pulling in system has occurred a problem. Awesome. No, it shouldn't have a problem. Whatever. I'll spend 3 hours researching this. And what I'll do is this. Is say, for example, you're writing on Revelation, okay? The dating of Revelation. I'd go in there, and the first thing I do is I would just do Revelation, and I'd probably do date of Revelation. And then I'd go through all of those. Then I'd go through and I'd say, okay, after I've gone through those 300 and seen which ones were significant. And what's cool about EBSCO is whenever you have an article up there, and I can't show you because it's not letting me go beyond. When you have an article up there, you can click, put it in your folder, and in the top right corner, it's got your folder. You see where the folder is, that folder icon? When you get to the end of right there, this folder will you know, pop open like it's got something in it. Click on it and you can email all the articles to yourself so that you've got them all on a list. Sometimes you can download the article straight from EBSCO. Sometimes you got to go hunting for it. But what I'll do is after I do date of Revelation, then I'll put Domitian Revelation. Then I'll put a Jerusalem Temple Revelation. Maybe if I know that Revelation 17 is the passage that has the most debate about the date, then I'll put in Revelation 17. And I'll accumulate anywhere from 300 to 400 articles. Now, do I read all of those? No. Here's how you do it for undergrad. What you do is the first thing you do is which ones can I download? Second thing you do is which ones do we have in our library? And you get all those. The third thing is then you go back through the list and you see, are there any of these that I know I have to have? And then you do interlibrary loan. That's the three steps of doing it. Which ones can I download? Which ones do our library have? And if there's still one that I'm like, man, this one is talking directly about what I want to write about, then I go in interlibrary loan and get it. Now, what's the advantage? Now, notice what I haven't done yet. What have I not visited? Let's act like we're writing an exegetical. What have I not visited yet? Commentaries. You want to know why? Commentaries only have a very limited time to talk about something that's way more complicated than what they're actually saying. This is another like little tip. You know, we've been deconstructing a lot of the historical grammatical method. Commentaries are not that useful when you're trying to do deep research, because they've got a limited amount of time to talk about what they want to talk about. What they have to talk about, an entire book. A journal article? He can write 25 pages on one verse. That's deep exegesis. You always start there. Always. Because what this does is it tells you what scholarship's actually talking about. And from that, then you can move to commentaries at the end. But what you'll find when you're reading the commentaries after reading all the articles and reading your IVP dictionary is that everything the commentary is talking about, you've already read. That's what you'll find. And what I use commentaries for is sometimes they will say things in a very creative way that is helpful for me in my paper. That's really what I use them for. Sometimes they can just say things better than I can. And so I'll find whenever they say it better than me and I'll pull it out and use it as a quote. But my primary research, I don't use commentaries for at all. Does that make sense? Journal articles is where the cutting edge of scholarship always is, because they have more room to talk about whatever they want. See what I mean? For example, when I'm going to England, I'm presenting a paper at a conference, and it's 20 pages on 3 verses. That's it. I get to talk about the release of Satan for an hour. You don't get that in most commentaries. And whenever you do, like in Beale's commentary, it's a mess. Because they've got to listen to the editor more than they do what they want to chase. Does that make sense? Okay, first thing I start off with usually is EBSCO, and I will spend tracking them down, reading them. If I have 100 hours of research, about 60 to 70 hours of that would be spent at EBSCO. That's just percentage-wise. I'm not giving you actual hours, just percentage-wise. Then IVP dictionaries. And from those, then I branch out to the more fringe ones, and that's the commentaries. So I don't know what you've been taught before, but that's the most effective way to do research. Is this making sense? I'm getting blank stares. I hope this is helping. Yes?
With EBSCO, don't you have to have, like, password?
Yeah. Which since I'm logged into the Ozark network, it automatically pulls up the Ozark page, but we may be having some problems. I don't know. I'm not sure. But you do. The password's in the library. You have the password and your username. You log in, and then you're good to go. But spend your time there. And even on this project, you're going to want to spend the time there. The dating issues, use Carson, Moo, and Morris, or Carson and Moo, to point you to the articles you need to be reading. Okay? That makes sense? Then what do? I usually photocopy everything. I mark everything up. You don't have to do this. This is what I do. I mark everything up, highlight whatever's good in the text, and write my own comments and interact with it on the side. And then I go back through and I type all of that into a document. And then I make that document into an outline. I print off the outline, and that's the outline of my paper, and I type it straight from the quotes. They form my outline for me. And that's why whenever you look at the things I've written, there'll be 120 footnotes because I've interacted with the sources on that level. Does that make sense? It's a very simple process. It's not one I ever had told me when I was an undergrad. It's just one I had to make up, but I'm wanting to tell everybody else because it's worked so far. And hopefully you don't have, hopefully maybe I'm catching you earlier, maybe not. Anyway, that's what I do. But now I want to talk about authors, Roman authors in particular, that will be important for you in your study of your particular, and I'm putting this on here not because I enjoy PowerPoint, but because you're probably going to want to write these down, and I'm not going to be able to go slow enough talking to be able to do that. So we'll do it like this. Sorry. I'm not a PowerPoint guy. I just never have been. But sometimes it's necessary. Whatever. Okay, so we're going to be talking about introductory sources and methodology. I want to give you the sources first, and probably tomorrow we'll talk about the rest of the sources and methodology. But there are two different avenues of sources whenever you're dealing with Roman sources. Number one, you're dealing with direct historical sources. Direct. And then number two is what? Indirect historical sources. And that'll become clear once we get into it. Direct historical sources include narrative histories of Rome. These are authors that they have the intention of recording political events of the period. That's their point. Is they say, I'm going to sit down and write a history of Rome or of this time period. One of the very first ones is Velius Paterculus. He was writing in the 20 BC, and the CA, just to let you know, CA means circa, around or about. And you'll see that all the time when you're dealing with dating stuff. Around 20 BCE or BC. Again, BCE, you guys know those differences, right? Before the Common Era, which applied to before Christ and Ad Domini. Yes?
Can you put the slides on your website?
Yeah, I think I can do that. I don't know when I'll get to it because I fly out tomorrow. But maybe I'll tell my assistant to do that. We'll see if I remember. Sorry, email me or something. I don't have a good answer for that. Velius Paterculus, though, he wrote a two-volume work. And it begins with Greek mythology. He goes all the way back to Greek mythology, and he tries to write a history that spans the time up to 29 CE, which who was reigning during 29 CE, which is around the time of Christ? Who? You're right, whoever said it. Tiberius. That's right. So he goes all the way back to Greek mythology and traces all the way up. But his point is, his purpose is to give you a narrative history of Rome. To give you a history of the Roman Empire. Tacitus also has the same type of goal. From around 56, he lived around 56 to 120, which even those dates are quite significant. Because it will tell you what areas he was most authoritative in since he lived through it. As a matter of fact, I will say this too. The first three guys are Roman senators or Greek senators. Cassius Dio is a Greek senator, which means they have access to some of the inner annals of the Roman Empire. They had access to history that other people may not have had access to when they were writing their documents. Tacitus, he's known for three key works. He was writing primarily under the Flavian Empire around 88 BC is whenever he actually held the political office. Or not BC, sorry, CE, which would be the time of Domitian. His first work called Agricola, this was a book of a biography of his father-in-law. And he was the governor of Britain from 77 to 84, 85, right around in there. The second one is awesome. It's Histories. This will be really important for some of your works. Histories was published in 109 to 110, so at the very beginning of the second century. But it was comprised of 12 to 14 books. We don't know exactly how many. 12 to 14, and it stretched from the date of 69 to 96. What's significant about that? Yeah, in detail, he goes into the Galba situation that led to the author, led to Vitellius, that led to Vespasian, the rise of the Flavian Empire. And then he chronicles from 70 to 96 the reign of Vespasian, his son Titus, and his other son Domitian. And here's the problem. This actually really ticks me off, by the way, for what I want to research. This next fact makes me mad. We only have the first 4 1/4 books still around, because we've lost the rest of them. And that means we only get his writings up to 70 AD whenever Vespasian takes power. So we lose everything about Vespasian's reign, and we lose everything about Titus's reign, and everything about Domitian's reign. Nevertheless, lamentation needs to move on. He also wrote the Annals. And I'm telling you, the reason why, let me give you a reason why I'm going through these. You won't get this in any other class. And it's very a big shame, because these books directly impact our understanding of the Roman world. You want to know where we get this information? It's from these guys. This is where we get it. One of the reasons why we're so ignorant of what's happening around the time of the church is because we don't interact with these books, because we don't even know what a lot of them are. That's a big problem. Anyway, Annals, really important work as well. It originally consisted of 16 to 18 books, although we haven't lost half as many of these. 6 books was for Tiberius, 6 books was for Gaius and Claudius, and 4 to 6 books for Nero. We've lost most of book 5, which would have been in Tiberius's reign. We've lost all of book 7 through 10, which would have been Caligula, the first half of book 11, which is Claudius, and everything after book 16, so we lost the last part of Nero. However, we've got a lot of those other ones in there, so if you want to know about Nero, Claudius, Caligula, those guys, you need to be reading the Annals. Okay, Cassius Dio, Greek senator, he wrote an 80-book history of Rome. 80 books, stretching from the foundation of Rome to 229 CE. And he calls it Roman history. What's interesting about Dio Cassius, even though we actually have quite a lot of his books still intact, but he's blatantly pro-monarchy. Even whenever he's writing about the Republic before Augustus takes power and Julius Caesar and all them, before he's blatantly pro-monarchy. He says, if it wasn't for the monarchy, then the empire never would have been stable. And that's pretty significant. Then the fourth one you've heard of, but I want to talk about why he's significant. Why is Josephus such a significant author? What? Yes, he was Jewish. Does anybody know the story of Josephus that we can put together? Yeah.
Was he captured, and then he really liked Vespasian?
Oh yeah, you're reflecting on our lecture this morning. Awesome. Yes, that's true. He was a Jewish general at the beginning of the revolt in AD 66. He was one of the ones fighting for the Jews against the Romans that's causing the uprising in Jerusalem that leads to the destruction of the temple. But he's captured. Towards the very beginning, he's captured. And what he does is he does come to Vespasian, and the way he saves his own neck is he basically looks at Vespasian and he says, I know you're a general right now, but you were destined to be the emperor of this whole world. And Vespasian's guy, like, wow, what a nice guy. I think I'll keep him around. And he does. And what this Jewish general becomes is a propagandist for the Romans to the Jews. He writes Jewish wars as a way of trying to convince the Jews to look on the positive side about Rome. Matter of fact, he even declares Vespasian not only emperor, but Messiah in his writings. Josephus is very important because it is a Jew that's writing pro-Roman. So you get a conflation of what the Christians would have seen as a compromise and the Jews would have seen. Josephus was not a popular guy amongst his people, as you can imagine. He even comes up, and this is something I use in Acts, he comes up to the city, to a city at one point, and yells out to the Jews, repent and believe in me. Come to the side of the Romans, repent and believe in me. Ooh. That'll preach. Kingdom talk. Okay. Anyway, Josephus, he writes The Jewish Wars, which is a book that begins, it has a brief history of the Jews from the Maccabean Revolt up to 66 CE. It just kind of like sums that up really quick. And then what he does, but his primary purpose was to write an account of the uprising of the Jews, trying to show them that they should bow their knee to the Romans because they were God-ordained to begin with. Even calling Vespasian a messianic figure, referring back to Numbers 24:17. He then writes Antiquities of the Jews, but he writes it not for Jews, but for Romans. And what he does is he traces the history of the Jews from creation up to 66 CE, before Romans started to really not like the Jews. And basically it's an apologetic for the Romans to say, hey, don't wipe us all off the face of the earth, we're not that bad. Trying to, some sense, talking both sides out of his mouth, where he's looking at the Jews with Jewish wars, saying, Romans are pretty good. And he looks at with Antiquities to the Romans, he says, Jews are pretty good. He's kind of a liaison between the two. Does that make sense? That'll change the way you read Josephus. Matter of fact, his name was Flavius Josephus, by the way, which comes from the Flavian dynasty, Vespasian, etc. Question? Comment?
One question is, is there a better way than just reading it all to pick through these lengthy books and stuff, because there's probably only very narrow information that you can use in these papers about that. And I went through annals and stuff like that, and it took a lot of time to really pull stuff that I could actually apply to.
Yeah, let me give you a couple comments on that, because that's a legitimate question. Let me start off with kind of the exhortation, and then I'll start off with some shortcuts. That's research. It's brutal, but it pays huge dividends. And you will read 500 pages, and you'll get about two paragraphs that really impact what you're really wanting to get at. And that's just the way it is. And it's annoying, and yet it's fun all at the same time. I think it's fun all at the same time. Now let me say this. Logos is awesome. It's just great. Because whenever you do a Greek word study, you can also do a Greek word study through Josephus. And now with Perseus being downloaded to Logos, you can do a Greek word study through every single one of these. So word studies can somewhat summarize these for us if you read the right context. Another way of doing shortcuts is reading other authors that are interacting with this in a way that's positive, seeing where they point you, then you go and read them yourselves. They can do some of the work for you. However, I'll be honest with you, the coolest things that I've ever discovered is whenever I was reading a book of 1,000 pages and then thought, oh, I'm not saying you have to do that for this class. I'm just trying to be real about research.
Finite time.
I understand that. I'm a finite human being.
Yeah.
I get it. But what I'm saying is just there are some shortcuts in research, but there aren't many. Am I saying you have to read 1,000 pages so that you can get two nuggets to add into your assignments? No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. However, what I am saying is it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard. It's just the way it is. And I'm sorry for that, kind of. And I think, I don't know if I've said it in here or not, but if I have, I'll say it again. The only things that you will ever be proud of that you do in your life are the things that almost broke you to accomplish. Just the way it is. We can act like, I mean, honestly, the things I'm most proud of that I've accomplished are the things that have been the hardest, like raising kids. It's one of the things I'm most proud of, but it is stinking hard. I mean, it's really hard. I mean, I thought that getting married showed me how selfish I was, and then I had three kids, and I realized, oh my gosh, I'm really selfish. You know, and the things you're most proud of are the things that take the longest, that takes the hardest. And same thing with research. Same thing with research. And this is the bummer, the stuff we're doing and we're talking about right here is the cutting edge of research right now. The stuff you'll be doing is what other New Testament scholars haven't been doing for the past 30 to 40 years. It's going to be hard. Oh, but when you're done with it, it'll be fantastic. Real quick, let me finish up Josephus. Oh, he's done. Okay, tomorrow we'll start up with some of the other sections, and then we will get into sovereign and subject narratives. Oh, that's when it gets fun. Hey, man. Love you guys. See you tomorrow.